And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Good news on the environmental front seems to be growing rarer, much like many of the plants and animals we care about which add the wonder to our mix. But rarer indeed is the story we are about to tell today. And it's not good news. It's fantastic news. One of America's rarest birds, believed extinct by most accounts, has been rediscovered. And today, we hear it from the source, from the director of the Cornell Laboratory of Anthropology. It's a mystery with a bit of miracle mixed in. When we return to your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
And welcome back to our birding life lists, the possibility of adding one of our nation's most amazing birds. In a bit, we are going to hear the story, a most amazing story indeed, of the rediscovery of a single bird species, the legendary ivory-billed woodpecker, which has not been seen anywhere for over 60 years. But today, you will hear Dr. John Fitzpatrick, director of the Cornell Laboratory of Anthropology in Ithaca, New York, who was personally involved in the quest to prove the existence of this bird of legend, the ivory-billed woodpecker. This is so much more than a story about nature. It is a story of luck, wild luck, that is still unfolding. We cover this breaking news feature in segments 2 and 3 of today's show. Following the news, you know, summer is coming. The days are lengthening, the winds are warming, trails are greening up, and so it's time to think about a good getaway into the wild. Well, I came across a wonderful new bit of gear. It's a tenter's dream, a tent you string between two trees, enclosed and off the ground, enclosed in netting and with a good-sized rain shield. Lightweight. Well, we talked with Rob Hart, whose Crazy Creek products seem to focus on keeping your butt off the boulders. So, a fun show. A great way to welcome the summer of hope. But first, the news. For those who still can't make up their mind about global warming, a report released late last week in conjunction with some high-ranking researchers with NASA gives you one last chance to be one of the last humans on the planet to warm up to the truth. The report says that the 21st century will experience a 1 degree Fahrenheit rise in temperature. But that's not all, or perhaps better put, but it could be much more than that. Climate change takes a long time to manifest, so although changes may seem small, they could spin out of control, their words, and bring temperature shifts ranging from 2.4 to over 10 degrees Fahrenheit. The primary cause is that the Earth is keeping 1 watt of energy more than it is returning to space. Therefore, through time, things warm up. The director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, James Hansen, stated, "There can no longer be genuine doubt that human-made gases are the dominant cause of observed warming. This energy imbalance is the smoking gun that we have been looking for. So, that's the final word. Things are heating up on planet Earth." In a unique political maneuver, the House and Senate cleared the way for drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Now, to be clear, they never actually voted on it. Rather, they mandated Congress to find clever ways to make money by saving money, or save money by making money, something like that. And decisions like this are not subject to Senate filibuster rules. Therefore, in plans laid by Senator Pete Domenici and Representative Richard Pombo to make money to save money, drilling for oil in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Hey, that's okay. Constituents who may have had ideas on how to make money by saving money or save money by making money, are encouraged to send their ideas to Senator Pete Domenici and Representative Richard Pombo, who, like the President's wish to save Social Security, certainly are open to all good ideas. And Santa Claus is looking into hybrid reindeer in an effort to decrease greenhouse gases. The world's richest nations, like the United States, Europe, China, and Japan, feeling the effects of high oil prices, are encouraging everyone in the world to hurry up and quit using so much oil, because we can't afford it. With oil prices not yet fueling an inflationary spiral in the world economies, nevertheless, with the U.S. stating that high oil prices could be around for years, it's really just a matter of time. U.S. Energy Secretary Sam Bodman said at the Paris meeting, "Energy markets, as exemplified by current oil prices, are really a global problem that was many years in the making and undoubtedly many years in the solving. So, what are we waiting for? Let's make new energy our number one priority." So says Wildsmith, speaking about these events on the Wild Side News. Thinking about cloning your goldfish? Do it while you still can. California lawmakers rejected a recent proposal to ban the cloning of pets. Following the news that a San Francisco company, Genetic Savings and Clone Incorporated, recently collected final payments upon the delivery of a cloned pet dog to a Texas client who paid $50,000 for a new little Nikki, California legislators didn't have the stomach to potentially choke the life out of their $3 billion backing of stem cell research, the largest public green pool in the U.S. So, hurry up and get little Muffy to the clone shop before it's shut down. Bob Hunter, founder of Greenpeace, died recently after a long fight with prostate cancer. The journalist turned activist harnessed his sense of humor and media savvy to literally put his life on the line in the defense of nature. That line was crossed finally. May he now enjoy peace until he returns, if he thinks he's needed. Real California hunters were glad to help inaugurate a ban on online hunting, saying hunting over the internet is unethical and unsporting. Groups including the California Sportsmen's Association and Safari Club International said, "Not in our state. Not while we're here." The Texas business continues its trade in hunting by mouse clicks. And that nifty mother duck successfully hatched her 11 eggs in Washington, D.C., in Rock Creek National Park, where she was escorted to water with no fewer than three federal agencies accompanying her and her little quackies. Once at the river, the mother and goslings leapt into the new home, with one straggler, who didn't like water, left behind. But eventually, all 12 little mallard members set off on their next adventure. Good luck, little duckies! And that's the news. Makes you want to pack up your goods and head on out to the woods for a bit. Well, when you do, you might want to consider a great new way to do it, with an update on an old idea that makes camping easier, even in crowded woods. I'm peering down into a hammock, and in the hammock is a man, and the man is named Rob Hart. He's the chairman of Crazy Creek Products Incorporated out of Red Lodge, Montana. I'm kind of trying to awaken him here to talk about in particular, his new product, that which I find kind of interesting. But let's talk about Crazy Creek first. Rob, let's talk about Crazy Creek and how it is you got into this thing and what Crazy Creek primarily promotes.
Crazy Creek products started 18 years ago, and it all came because I was a mountain guide who wanted more comfort in the wilderness. So I bought a sewing machine, and I had an idea, and one thing led to another, and before I knew it, after a year of making prototypes, I decided I had to incorporate and sell the product myself.
So what kind of product was it that you needed more comfort with?
A seating product. So hence I made the first Crazy Creek chair, which is now synonymous with outdoor camping comfort.
And so this is a folding, lightweight, durable chair?
Correct.
Now, if people wanted to look at that chair, how could they find that?
Well, they can look on our webpage, which is crazycreek.com, or they can go to one of their favorite specialty outdoor retailer stores, and I'm sure they'll find the Crazy Creek products well displayed in any given store, from REI to Sports Chalet to a host of others that the list would be too long to name.
I'm going to turn my back on Rob. He's still in the hammock here. And as I look around, I see an array of unusual chairs. These unusual chairs that just kind of fold out and hang. Let's talk about that for a little bit.
Well, there's a large line of chairs. It starts with our Adventure line, which is the mainstay of Crazy Creek's products that I started with over 18 years ago. And that has evolved into chairs that incorporate sleeping pads. So it's a cover for a sleeping pad that makes it into a dual-use product. I've made chairs for canoes to make paddling more comfortable for one's back and rear side. And also I make them for sit-on-top kayaks as well.
Sounds like kind of a cush job.
Not bad. And we also now have a new line called the Airline, which incorporates an air bladder within the chair, and when you're using air, it's all fluid instead of sitting on foam or foam with air. And ours has a new adjustable valve which will let you dial in your comfort level, so you can go from firm to medium to all the way to almost like a flat tire if you prefer, but they will all keep you comfortable. It's a bladder that encapsulates air, and one with a unique valve, one can just tap on the valve and the air will release at a given rate to where all of a sudden you say, ah, that's perfect.
You spend a lot of time enjoying yourself, don't you? But here's the deal. From what I understand, you've got a new product coming out. Actually, it's an improvement on an existing product. And it's the product that you're lying in right now. And that's why this has been kind of a difficult. My arm is actually going to sleep as I stick my arm over the hammock edge to talk with Rob in the hammock. Talk about this hammock, because it's really quite interesting. It caught my eye. It's one of these products at the conference here that definitely catches your attention.
Well, this is our new version, LEX Ultralight. And being ultralight seems to be what more people who are traveling into the wilderness or backcountry today, and even car camping and boating camping, want things to be lighter and just as durable as something that is heavy. So I put myself in the position of creating one that now, from my previous model, is 1 pound lighter. And may not sound like a lot, but 1 pound is 1 pound, because some people just care about a few ounces. And it's a lighter weight material. It's a full bug netting that encapsulates the hammock. We still have left the amenity for a sleeve that you can put in your desired type of sleeping pad, whether it be a self-inflating or just a straight foam pad. And I changed the tarps material from a 1.9-ounce ripstop nylon to a 30D, which is for denier, Cordura high tenacity silicone impregnated nylon, which is one step above what a normal parachute type nylon is, strongest there is on the market today.
So this is a classic hammock, except this is supported by straps that you would put around any two supporting poles, which could be trees or other supports. And then it has a little circular loop that easily allows this mosquito netting to kind of slide up over you to keep you free from the bugs. And then, of course, over all of that is the rain shield that keeps you dry in inclement weather. And the thing I can definitely appreciate about it is the fact that this does not weigh very much, probably doesn't take much room, and it is pretty easy to put up and keeps you off the ground. It's a really miraculous little device.
Well, thank you for that observation. Yes. What is unique about this from all other hammocks is we are the only hammock that attaches to its desired anchor position or post via straps and a parachute-type buckle. So one doesn't have to be caught up in thinking that they mistied the knot. It's very user-friendly, and so when you get into it, you know you're secure. And in using straps instead of knots along with the buckle, you can tension it to your desired tension level. So if you want to have a classic hammock banana type frame to your body and be in that position, then that's easily done. But if you want to make it as taut as possible, that's just as easily done.
So it's kind of a release and tug and then tying it back in through the buckle.
Correct. And the buckle is very user-friendly. We try to make things at Crazy Creek comfortable and user-friendly.
Oh, look at the owner.
Here I am. I really do enjoy my work.
He's got his feet up here. He's got some sandals on. He's lying here in his shorts with a big grin on his face. That's the biggest smile I think I've seen here yet. If people want to get a product like this, what are they going to have to put out?
Just south of $200.
Okay, so about $1.99 times 100, huh? Well, Rob Hart, I want to thank you for whatever it is you've been doing here, taking it easy and having a great discussion about your new product. And I look forward to seeing this around.
Okay. Well, I look forward to hearing this on the internet radio.
There you have it. Bye.
And since we're talking about getting out, I have a free gift to the first person who can send me an email with air grill blower in the subject line. The air grill blower is a small hand-cranked high-velocity blower that takes those morning coals and blows them into the fire that brews that first cup of Java in the morning. So it's yours free if you're the first person to email me right now, air grill blower. Put that in your subject line and send it to Wildside News at cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.net. When we return, we enter the Wonder Zone. It's the story of the year. It's the miracle of the ivory-billed woodpecker. Here on your Voice of the Earth on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
In just a moment, we get to our feature story. But here's something I want each of you to do while I take a little break. Quick, grab your favorite bird field guide and see what it says about the ivory-billed woodpecker. With that, you'll be armed to really appreciate what you are about to hear. So while I talk, start walking to your bookshelf or backpack and look it up. Go on. I'll even bet some of you may not see it listed. See, it's supposed to be extinct. Wrong. We're off to Cornell's Laboratory of Ornithology when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The Catch River National Wildlife Refuge in Arkansas is a huge 500,000-acre tangle of trees and water, snakes, and bugs. It's a truly wild zone that sees a few hunters and adventurers each year, but it's primarily a wildlife sanctuary. That may be one of the reasons for the story that follows. For within those confines lived one of America's most legendary birds, the ivory-billed woodpecker. And what makes this story so amazing is that until this last year, it was pretty much considered extinct.
Joining us now on the phone is Dr. John Fitzpatrick, who is the director of the legendary Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology located in Ithaca, New York. Dr. Fitzpatrick, welcome to the Wild Side News.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, you have some extraordinary good news. In this era where there is so much challenging news coming from the environmental realms, this is an amazing story. Why don't you tell us the basic story, and then we'll kind of search it out a little bit.
Well, the headlines of the story are headlines that every bird lover for the last three generations has been dying to hear. Namely, the ivory-billed woodpecker is not extinct. We have discovered and proven the existence of at least one individual in the woods of eastern Arkansas.
Well, now, a lot of people who may not be familiar with this bird may kind of go, well, okay, great, there's another woodpecker out there that we thought didn't exist, but this is no ordinary bird.
That's exactly right. This bird is a bird of legend. It's a bird of huge mystery. It has been very rare for 150 years. It's been on the edge of or considered past extinction for all of the 20th century. It was rediscovered several times in the middle part of the 20th century, 1920, when already it was believed extinct, and then again in 1935. But after 1944, when the birds in Louisiana disappeared, until the present, there has never been a conclusively documented sighting of this bird. And it's also spectacular. It is a huge woodpecker, America's biggest. It was Audubon's, one of his favorite birds. He called it Van Dyke bird because of its extraordinary color and contrast with big lightning bolts of white down an ebony back, black back and a scarlet-red crest. It's a bird that every bird lover for the last 50 years has grown to view with a huge degree of fantasy and mystery, wishing, hoping against hope that he could see it.
The bird is legendary because of its size. That's one of the reasons this sighting was so spectacular, because literally sighting this bird is an experience. Why don't you give people a sense of just how big this bird is?
It's the third largest woodpecker in the world. For any listener familiar with the pileated woodpecker, which is a relatively familiar bird of North America, which is itself a massive woodpecker, as big or bigger than a crow, the ivory-billed woodpecker is 20% larger than a crow, than a pileated woodpecker in measurements, but 80% larger than a pileated woodpecker in weight. It's a truly massive woodpecker, and in fact, it used its size to get into the bark of big dying trees before other woodpeckers could get there. It was powerful enough with a big chisel-like bill to chip away the bark of dying trees before any other woodpecker was able to get that bark off, and therefore reach these big grubs of wood-boring beetles that were feeding on the dying inner bark before any other woodpecker could do that. So it had a special place in the big southern forests during the days when there were old dying trees.
I know for myself, I've been fortunate to see a number of pileated woodpeckers. We talked about Helmer Myrie State Park over in Wisconsin, and my first sighting was as if I was witnessing a dinosaur flying. I mean, this is a spectacular bird.
Right. The big woodpeckers, in fact, this is true all over the world, the big woodpeckers are always really exciting, thrilling birds to see, and even the pileated is a thrilling bird to see still. It does have a sort of a reptilian look. They're somewhat long-necked and the big long bill and the kind of a wild-looking eye, and of course these great red crests that are true of many of the larger woodpeckers. And because they're so big and often they have black and white patterns, they just have a very magical look as they fly, or as they're working away on some dead trees.
Well, now the story of this particular revival of this bird is an amazing story all by itself. This is just a current story of which legends will be long lived. The rediscovery of this bird, give us some of that history.
It happened on the day before Abe Lincoln's birthday, 2004, February 11th, when a very good woodsman from Hot Springs, Arkansas, by the name of Gene Sparling, kayaking through the bayou in the Cache River, White River area, pausing for a moment just to take in the sights and sounds of the woods, had a woodpecker fly toward him and land just 20 meters from him on the butt of a tree, and look at him and hitch back and forth a little bit, and he, very familiar with the woods, realized that this was what he refers to as a pileated on steroids. It was a very large woodpecker, quite unlike a pileated in that it had a long, thin neck, a very thin, tapered crest that was not the bright red and bushy crest of a pileated, but it had a black forepart to the crest. And most importantly, he saw the big white area on the lower wings, covering the whole lower back as the bird perched. He knew enough about the woods and had seen dozens, hundreds of pileateds throughout his life that he knew this was not the more common big woodpecker, but indeed that it looked a lot to him like an ivory-billed woodpecker. He posted an obscure reference to this event without mentioning the bird's name on a canoeing website, and that came to the attention of Tim Gallagher, who is the editor of our great bird magazine called Living Bird. And Tim talked to Gene, thought it sounded credible enough. He was flabbergasted by how good Gene's details were, and so he met Gene out there with Tim's friend Bobby Harrison. The two of them were guided by Gene through the bayou, and on their second day, very close to where Gene first spotted the bird, darned if they didn't have the incredible good luck of this bird flying right in front of them, just 20 meters away, and they got a great look of the bird flanking in the sun, and they both actually shouted and pointed at it, yelling ivory-billed at the same time, and actually they think scared it away from what it might have done, which was to land on a tree. So they had seen this bird. In fact, Bobby Harrison knelt down and wept a minute or two afterwards on the when they came to land, and Tim came back to the lab of ornithology, and a couple of days later met me and told me the story, and we just, when I asked him the question, Tim, what are the chances this was not an ivory bill, he said, zero, Fitz, it was purely an ivory bill. That was in March of 2004, and we've been working on it ever since.
So now you've heard that there is an ivory-billed woodpecker. What was your reaction?
Well, I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned. When Tim first told me the story, first of all, I should mention that he looked terrible. He had gone without sleep for a few days. I thought he was going to tell me that he had a bad disease, literally. he just was very tense and nervous and excited, and when he told me first, I said, just wait, Tim, I gotta stop you. I ran and got a tape recorder, I turned it on, and I just said, start from the beginning, just tell me the whole thing again. And I grilled him, and when he convinced me that he was absolutely positive, 100% positive of the identification, I just said, well, we gotta start working on this. I mean, I thought, this is the dream come true. We've fantasized about this in other times. We were involved in a big search in Louisiana several years ago. During that time, we'd fantasized about what to do if we actually encountered one.
But you probably never really thought you really would.
Well, I mean, you know, that's exactly right. I mean, a bird that is probably extinct, although you're hoping for the best, hopes had been fading. And you're right. There is this thing in the back of your mind saying, I'm chasing a ghost here. What am I doing? So when this news came for us, we thought, well, okay, this is right down our bread and butter as far as the Lab of Ornithology, the kind of thing that we do, try to get in and get a major piece of research done, working at the same time with conservation organizations. So immediately we contacted the Nature Conservancy in Arkansas, and it turns out they had already heard this news quietly. So we began a partnership between the two of us, the two organizations, that included all of the other people that had heard the news, and we agreed we needed to keep very carefully controlled the number of people who knew while we got research going while we raised some money to pay for some research and to pay for some significant land conservation, and also to begin working with the agencies to think about the management of the habitat and to get prepared for potential management of a major attraction of people, bird watchers and sightseers who might come in for this reason. So we decided to keep it secret, and we succeeded actually in keeping it secret for 14 months while we got an enormous amount of work accomplished, including the big event, which was David Luno's historic recording of a video clip of this bird on April 25th of 2004.
So then began a very challenging process of really confirming this. I mean, you have to now verify this from a number of perspectives and with expertise. What was involved with that?
Well, that's exactly right, that a few really, really high-quality sight records are exciting, but they're not sufficient for a bird of this degree of rarity to constitute proof of its existence. And in our view, everybody's view, the key element for proof was to get a photograph or a video. That became the obsessive quest over the remainder of the spring of 2004, culminating in David Luno's video of the 25th of April, which was not a great video, but it was it's a hallmark of David Luno that he had wisely recognized that all the sightings to date were so quick that he needed to have the camera rolling all the time. And in addition, he needed to have some good luck. Well, he got both of those. He had the video running one afternoon, and they flushed a bird out from right in front of them, and it flew in exactly the right direction to be captured for a total of 4 seconds on his video screen. That was enough to prove to us ornithologists that the bird existed. But frankly, the video, which is visible on the website, ivorybill.org, you'll see the video is not that great. It's pretty blurry. It's only a teeny little portion of the lower left corner of the frame. But it's sufficient, it turns out, after a careful study, to prove the identity of the bird, and that was the important thing. The end of the spring of 2004 came without any additional evidence. We tried putting some sound recording units out in the woods and got a few tantalizing sounds, but what we knew we had to do was gear up for a major session during the 2005 breeding season, winter and spring, when the leaves are dropped again and when we could have a chance with a lot of people spread over a big area to get some more information about this focal bird or birds. The key was to have people scouring a few of the best possible areas. Number one, the region broadly around the place where the birds were first seen. And number two, more broadly across the White River National Wildlife Refuge, with hopes that we could document the existence of other birds and thereby begin to understand how many birds might live in this area.
Now, how many people were involved in that, and then how many sightings did you actually encounter?
We've had, in our peak time, we had 20 people down there full-time in these two different areas, and a few extra volunteers working for 1 or 2 weeks at a time. And we did it from December 1st until May 1st. We ended up accumulating about 15 total sightings that were possible, of which 7 we concluded to be filled with enough detail and a long enough sighting, many of them through binoculars, that we could consider definitive. So we really published the article with a total of 7 positive encounters, with some others that were possible. And we also we put in a lot of acoustic listening devices across the forest and got some very tantalizing sounds, particularly the double knock display raps that these birds make, characteristic of the ivory-billed woodpecker. We aren't yet completely positive that those constitute the woodpecker, although the circumstantial evidence is very strong that they do.
So now what? There is one ivory-billed woodpecker. If you were in charge of this, what would you do? When we return, we find out what the plans are now that this elusive animal has come back to life. The story continues on your Voice of the Earth, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Imagine for a moment that you're a hand of the golden bubble, a most precious and fragile form, and it is up to you to keep it from popping. Well, our story continues, a story that is your personal gift, a story as fragile as a golden bubble. Let's find out how we keep this treasure alive, if we can, when we return with the voice of the earth and the voice of yet another wonder, the call of the ivory-billed woodpecker, which still touches deep into the woods of the Catch River National Wildlife Refuge. Listen. So what now? One ivory-billed woodpecker has been spotted. What's next? We find out as we continue with Dr. John Fitzpatrick. Well, now, of course, the tough question is, how is it that a bird that has not been spotted, a bird of this caliber and size since 1944, has been able to be in these woods somehow and reappear? What are some of the speculations?
There are a couple of things at work here. Number one, the bird has always been difficult to find for the last 150 years of its existence.
Hmm.
And number two, not very many skilled birders have been working in this huge wooded area. And number three, it is huge. It's 500,000 acres of forest. It's visited by hunters and fishermen from in thinly distributed numbers over a few months each winter. But really, it's a pretty unknown place. In fact, Arkansas was kind of off the radar screen for ivory-billed hunters until relatively recently. By far, the most important thing is that this land for the last 30 years has been the attention of some very, very concerted conservation efforts by the Nature Conservancy, a private organization, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. So increasingly it is under protection and therefore growing back. And so it begins to be a better and better place for the ivory bill. And there really is the heart of the story of the future. Because this woods, in the long run, we're in the process now, the early stages of regrowing back the old bottomland forests that used to be the haunts of this woodpecker.
Hmm.
Right now these forests are significantly younger than 100 years old. Post-logging. And the ivory bill lived in places that had 200, 300, 400-year-old trees in it. So in the big picture, the bird needs a large amount of very old forest, and we're in the process of growing that back. There's been a great head start out there, and hopefully the next few decades, we add to the total extent, and we begin doing the management required to commit to what I refer to as regrowing a really old forest.
At this point, what is your speculation in terms of the total numbers of animals that exist?
Well, we really don't know how many exist. We're completely confident that the number is at least one, and of course the difference between one and zero is enormous.
Yeah.
We also observe that woodpeckers living beyond the age of 15 are extremely rare, so the odds are that this bird is somewhere between 2 and 12 years old.
Hmm.
And therefore, the bird was hatched and raised by successfully breeding parents sometime in the 1990s or even in this century.
Hmm.
That's the highest probability. And that means that the bird's been breeding somewhere long after most ornithologists had given up hope on it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where yet, and we don't know how many that is, but the chances that we're looking at what's literally the last individual of its kind seem to us to be remotely small. What's much more likely is that there is a very thinly distributed breeding population, perhaps as little as a few breeding pairs, that exists throughout that White River, Cache River system. The best thing we can say and the best thing we can hope for is that as time goes on, that forest is getting better and better because it's getting older and older. So their breeding success, we hope, should be able to turn around and begin to go in a positive direction.
Well, now this is where science gets challenging, because I'm sure you're torn between what the proper thing to do is. And also, at this point, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about what the public should be aware of in terms of not trying, you know, some birders are really fanatical about getting adding a species like this to a life list, and that could be very damaging to this particular moment.
Right. We are concerned that the bird be treated with enormous respect, that the bird and its place be treated with huge respect, that the likelihood is high that many people will want to jump in there and try to see it. I haven't seen it yet personally, and I would love to see it, and everybody who's a passionate birder would love to see it. Everybody needs to also know that it is excessively difficult to see. We've documented literally thousands of person hours for the 7 really high-quality sightings that we've accumulated. And the process of having hundreds or thousands of people running through the woods trying to find it would actually be very detrimental. So we are trying to ask people to be very respectful. There are a few places set up down there by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as access points, and we've already worked over this last year with the service to suggest methods that are as good as any for giving yourself a chance of seeing it. And those methods do not include diving down deep down inside the forest and tromping through and camping. It's a very difficult place physically to work. It's very exhausting to work in there. And it is filled with poisonous snakes, cottonmouths. It's thick with cottonmouths and mosquitoes in the summertime. So it's a rather inhospitable spot to be working.
Now, if a person were to actually see this animal, what would you recommend they do?
If somebody sees this bird, by far the most important thing to do is to get a picture of it. We have a problem that many, 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 many people are contacting us right now, describing birds in their backyards that they're seeing that they think are ivory-billed, and you know, it's almost impossible that they are. And everybody needs to recognize that. Almost everybody is reporting to us something that is a pileated woodpecker, and that's going to be true of most of the people who think they've seen it in this woods also. Recognize that professionals have been trying for a year across the entire region to be seeing it, and 7 times over a few seconds each they've seen it. So remember that you're almost certainly seeing pileated. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pileated for every one ivory bill that you might see down there. So, A, be very careful and very cautious and very conservative about your identification. Report only something that you're positive about, and if possible, get a picture.
Now, what is the most notable field mark for the ivory bill?
There's absolutely the diagnostic thing that must be seen for this to have a chance is a very, very large patch of white all across the back of the wing. And I underscore that, all across the back of the wing. Pileated woodpeckers do have a lot of white in their wings. And so when you see one flying away from you, you'll see a bird with white in its wings. That's not enough. You need to see a massive patches of snow white in the back of both wings as the bird's flying. It's a very large woodpecker. It can fly very rapidly. Several of the people who saw it report it flying a bit like a loon overhead. So it's a large woodpecker with a huge amount of white in the wings. Don't be concerned about the bill and the red crest. Look for the white in the wings. In fact, Tim Gallagher and Bobby Harrison's extremely experienced effort to look for this bird, when they saw that bird, they couldn't even remember what the head or tail looked like.
Mm.
They were so riveted on watching the wings and the pattern of white in the wings.
Mm.
So that's the thing to see.
Now you're torn in terms of what to really do. Let's, if this was the only individual left, this is where science becomes difficult. You have tough decisions to make.
Well, in the case of woodpeckers, it's not that tough. First of all, we'd never know for sure that it's the only individual. And in the case of woodpeckers, they're very difficult to keep in captivity and extremely difficult to breed in captivity. So the notion of capturing the bird and keeping it in the cage is basically not one of the options. The true option here is to work as hard as we can to make a place where this bird can find a mate and raise babies. That's what we're after. And so it's really a conservation effort, not a rescue effort.
Now, I've heard that Secretary of Interior Gail Norton has really stepped up to assist in this process.
She's Gail Norton's very interested in the process. She immediately, upon hearing this, said, well, we should be involved. We must do something. She committed last Thursday $10 million of this year's money towards programs of habitat restoration, landowner incentives for reforestation, and research. And the Interior Department has talked about this being a multi-year, multi-million dollar effort to really work on the big picture with the local community, making a cooperative conservation effort that involves private lands and private incentives, as well as public management and law enforcement. So she's quite interested in it. She was very, very excited and very engaged in the process leading up to the press conference.
This story will continue, and if people want to follow this into the years ahead here, what's the best way for them to do so?
They can pay attention to the, I mentioned the partnership that formed as the project began last March, and that partnership continues. It's called the Big Woods Conservation Partnership. The Nature Conservancy and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology are leaders in it, but it includes a bunch of other public and private agencies. And you can follow that partnership and look for news on it at ivorybill.org on the website.
And that's also where they can see this momentary little clip of this bird.
That's right. The that site has a clip. It has reference to the science article that they can go directly to. It has a lot of ancillary pictures of the place. And it will be the place, along with our own website at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
Why don't you go ahead and give that URL?
birds.cornell.edu. Both of those sites will keep the public posted on what's developing in the story. We will be working together with the American Birding Association to put out strong recommendations for how people should treat this story from the birding perspective. And we'll continue to do research in the area. We will no doubt be engaging volunteers in the process. We encourage people to look in other parts of the southern forest that are growing back in case it's not only the big woods that have a bird or two in it. And in general, we've basically given the ivory-billed woodpecker a new lease on life in terms of human interest in it for the next 50 years. Hopefully that involves growing back the great big forests of the Deep South.
Well, Dr. John Fitzpatrick, the director of the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, thanks so much for telling us this amazing story here on the Wild Side News, and I hope we have a chance to talk again and get an update.
It's been my great pleasure, and I look forward to that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot.
The wonders can cease, but for now, a gift to us all. Lest we ever take it for granted, we end today's show with just a reminder of the mystery that we must never cease to know, for nothing that we will ever create will compare. If you can, be sure to take a look at today's show page to see the picture. It's a picture of a plant and a bird. The South African plant, the Babiana regnus, has scarlet flowers and grows somewhat close to the ground. Its leaves are long and curved, but perhaps through some strange design flaw, the bird, the malachite sunbird, that best spreads the pollen to other plants, cannot easily reach into the flower for the nectar from the ground. Perhaps at some time a special bee or butterfly or hummingbird would do this, but now a bird is given the task, due mostly to a unique adaptation by this flower. To help the bird get far enough off the ground to get to the nectar, the plant grows a long, stout stick, a perch, just for the bird. I invite us all to wonder how. Let us all celebrate this day as a gift to the power of life. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again each Thursday or anytime on the archives on your Voice of the Earth here on the Wildside News.